Welcome to Conversations with Evie and Elizabeth by Empower Survivors. This is a recording from our online meetings program happening every Monday evening at 6 p.m. Central Time. Each week, we will introduce conversation starters and discuss issues of interest for survivors of childhood sexual abuse and trauma. Evie and Elizabeth help you feel relaxed and supported in this interactive group that meets weekly to discuss issues pertaining to healing, wellness, mental health, and more. If you want to participate in the live meeting, engage in the conversation, or find some support, register online at empowersurvivors.net for our next live Zoom meeting. Privacy of all participants is a priority for us, so only our guest talk is being recorded for this podcast. Join us from the comfort of your own home as we introduce special guests and topics that are sure to be of interest. This is Elizabeth. I am the CEO and founder of Empower Survivors, a nonprofit organization of survivors helping survivors of childhood sexual abuse, providing safe spaces of healing. Visit our website and join the community at empowersurvivors.net. We don't have to do this alone. We believe you, we see you, we hear you, and we are here for you now. Would you like me to introduce you as that then? Should we go ahead and start the show all over?
My way here, but it's just great to be with you all tonight. And I try to talk about what I went through as honestly and as in depth as I can, but also as light as I can too, because the only thing that's got me through some of this hurt and pain was to look at laughter, was to look at the one light of sunshine going through the sky of dark clouds. So every now and then, you know, people think I have a strange sense of humor, but that's my way of dealing with life. You got to find fun. And I keep telling everybody at the office, when this stops being fun, I'm going home today. And when it gets stressful, it's like, okay, I'm out of here. Where are you going? That's no fun today. So I'm going back home. Let me know if you need me. But I'll be glad to answer any questions. Anybody can jump in at any time and ask me whatever you want. I think, Elizabeth, my big hurdle in life was understanding that all of my life, there wasn't a day in my childhood that I wasn't abused. And so from the very first memory that I ever had of childhood, and I can tell you about that, it's all in the book. The book starts off with boom, this is what happened to me. Matter of fact, the first sentence in my book is, I don't remember a day in my childhood that I wasn't abused. That's the first sentence that you read. And the wild thing about this, I wrote this book for my kids, because about 3 years ago, nobody knew about this. My kids didn't know it. My wife didn't know it. I held it in. I didn't tell anybody. And when I ended up on an operating table having open heart surgery in my mid-40s, I realized that those things that I had hidden in my life were damaging me. Even though I had a wonderful, beautiful fake mask and smile, everybody would ask me, hey, how you doing? Hey, I'm fantastic. How are you? Or I'm fine, you know. And matter of fact, in my new book that's coming out, Overcoming the Darkness, I think it's chapter 2. I'm fine. It's called I'm Fine and Neither Are You. We use that line to get through so many days. But about 3-4 years ago, I guess the book's been out 3 years, so it's maybe been 4 years now, that I realized that my world was spinning out of control. Even though I was successful at Baylor College of Medicine, I was a successful speaker on professional attitudes and how to be organized, and I would speak around the country on that topic. But I knew there was something. Have you ever had the feeling, and I have no notes, so I just go from my heart. Have you ever had the feeling that you were alone in a room full of people. And that's where I started to notice what was going on. Even though I acted happy, when I went home, I was alone. And nothing brought me real happiness. And that started to wear on me emotionally. And when my world started just spiraling out of control, I realized that I needed to let that closet that had been locked for years open. And it had been locked for 35, almost 40 years. And I told my mom that I had been abused. I did not tell her to the degree that I've been abused. She claimed she didn't know it. She knew my dad had some very demented sexual thoughts. And apparently she was involved in that some way during their marriage. But I don't think she knew that I was being sexually abused every day. Although people, after they read my book, have written me all over the country saying, "Greg, are you crazy?" She had to know. She had to know. Stop denying this. But I'm going to give her face value because she is my mom. But when my mom came down with cancer and I went down to Orlando, Florida to be with her during that time, we spoke about it briefly. And I told her, I said, "Mom, I'm not going to tell anybody until you're gone. But when you're gone, I'm going to let this out to the world." And the day she died, I started to process the book in my head. As a matter of fact, when I drove from Orlando to Houston in her Cadillac, she built me her Cadillac. I drove from Orlando to Houston. I wrote the book and the chapters in my mind of how I was going to, first of all, tell my kids. So I wrote the book and sent the book in one chapter increments to my three boys. And said, "Guys," and they're 29, 30, and 31. They weren't at that time, but they were a little younger at that time. But I told them, I said, "I'm going to be sending you a chapter every other day." And they were shocked. It's like, "Dad, what is this?" And I want to let you know what happened to me. And then I decided, after they didn't disown me, that it was going to be okay to tell the world. And I've done that. And that was tough as a man. And I know we got at least one man. James is on tonight. I don't know if there's any other men on tonight. But, you know, as a man, this was tough. I questioned everything about my manhood, of being sexually abused by my dad in every single possible way that could be done. And then during my 11, 12, and 13 age years, I was gang raped by men. And then on Monday nights during that time, I was literally sold to my dad's friends every half hour, every hour throughout the Monday evenings. So it was a Monday night thing. I had to be home. I couldn't go to any school event. I couldn't, if I was on a sports team, I could not be at anything on Monday nights, because my dad would literally, I'd be in my bedroom and he would send one in. They would do their thing. There's a little Superman Hardee's glass that they gave away if you bought a meal at Hardee's, that they would put a tip in my glass jar or my glass cup on their way out, and the next man would come in. Sometimes it'd be a man and a woman. And that was every Monday night. And I would probably say, without exaggerating, 5 to 10, maybe an evening on Monday nights for a couple of years. And I just now started realizing, and I just now told that whole story is in the new book. That was one of the things that I mentioned in the first book. There's still a closet that I'm not for sure I'm willing to open. And on my show, Evie and Elizabeth, I was talking to somebody that was discussing human trafficking. And I mentioned, I said, "You know, can I ask you a question?" I started telling them my story. And they said, "Great, your dad trafficked you. And it's like, wow, I never really processed that. So I tell that story now, but that's brand new information that's coming out right now. During all those years, when I was 4, 5, 6 years old, I have to be honest with you. I didn't know what was going on. I knew the things that happened to me hurt sometimes. I didn't understand what was happening to my father's body and what was coming out of him and what it meant to him or any of that stuff because I was so young. I learned quick that if I did something wrong, he would do the old knuckles on the head of understanding you don't do that again. So I learned to be able to not scream out in pain, not to spit anything out, not to react in the wrong way. He had me groomed to where I was his literal toy. And at 4, 5, and 6, I remember going to school, wanting to ask my friends, Hey, what's your dad do to you? What's the things he do to you? You know, because I didn't understand. But then when it got to be 10, 11, I was on little league teams. And I started to understand, wait, this isn't normal. And then there was a summer that, and there's a whole chapter in the book, that I was gang raped after a party at my dad's house or our house. I was swimming in the pool and he told me to say goodnight to all the guests. And I went to my room. And when I was drying off, I turned around and there was 4 men and my dad, and they held me down and all of them gang raped me. I knew at that point it went from what I thought was normalcy to something that was evil. And from that point, it seems like it has escalated to a point of scars on my legs now, blood, pain, and them holding me down and literally using every part of my body that could be used. And I think the damning thing in that was the 4 men. One was the state's attorney in town. One was the chief of police. The other one was a morning talk show host in town. And the other was my dad's best friend. And I knew there wasn't going to be anybody that was going to believe me. Nobody in this world would believe me. And I was trapped. And about that time, it seemed like it was maybe between my 12th and 13th year birthday, my mom got a promotion. She worked for a huge propane gas company, and she was just over the local office there in Southern Illinois. But she got a 5-state area. So she would leave Sunday night and come back late Friday night. She was gone. When that happened, my world became living hell. I never took a shower alone. Dad never took a shower alone. Every time I took a shower, he was in there with me. Every time he came home from work and took a shower, I had to be in there with him. I never slept alone again. When mom was gone, I was sleeping with dad. And think about this. Not at 12 and 13 and 14 only, but at 15, 16 years old. And when I started to date at 16, got my driver's license, my first car I got to drive was my mom's Lincoln Continental. My dad drove a Cadillac. My mom drove a Lincoln Continental. And I drove the Lincoln Continental to school. We lived in a very high level area, upper middle class, predominantly white. My mom and dad were the leaders of the town clubs. Dad was president of the Lions Club on the trustee board at church. Mom was in the sorority club, and she was the the sorority queen, and all of this stuff. Everybody gathered at our house, and it was the place to be. When you drove by our house, everybody would slow down and go, "Oh, isn't that a beautiful home?" And when I was 16, I would be taking my girlfriend on a date. And the one rule at our house that was a mandated rule, you had to be home at midnight. If not, everything would break loose. So I knew I could not ever break that rule. So I would, after I would kiss my girlfriend goodnight at about 11:48, because I knew exactly how long it'd take me to floor that Lincoln to get home. I knew that after I would be kissing my girlfriend goodnight, within 15 minutes, I'd be walking in the door kissing my dad good evening. And if that doesn't take your brain and shake it up, I don't know what does. Every emotion, rage, anger, hatred, suicidology thoughts. I never thought about killing him, but I sure thought about killing myself. And that messed me up in major ways. And then it finally ended, I think, early July before I turned 17 years old. But that's my life in a nutshell. And I have a lot of specific instances, but I'd like to just take a breath and take a drink of Diet Coke if I can. If anybody has a question or a thought, jump in. And I just want to, James, you got a thought?
I just want to say, enjoy your Coke. And okay. I know you don't need to, I know you don't need to hear this, but I want to tell you that absolutely none of that whatsoever, any of that was your fault.
I appreciate that, James.
I know you don't need to hear, but I'm talking to the little boy inside you who probably maybe needs to be reminded of that. None of that was your fault. I relate to every word you said.
There's a chapter in the book, and I'm trying to think, and I love, not that I'm a great writer, but I love writing it, then reading it myself, called The Terrible Twins, and it's chapter 11, and I talk about, I invited these two people to come live inside of me, and they destroyed my home, they destroyed my thoughts, they destroyed everything, and I just let them stay there, and those residents were shame and guilt. And I do know that, James, but I do need to be reminded of that because it does haunt me. And the thing that haunts me, I think, the most is the way it stopped. And I'll be glad to go into that a little bit later if you want me to. I still think, why didn't I do that 4 years before? Why didn't I do that when I was 10? And I didn't. So that shame and guilt runs my home a lot in my mental attic. And I take 3 to 4 showers still a day now. I'm the cleanest person ever because I'm still trying to wash away the filth. And even though I know it's symbolic, it sure feels good to get in there and just let all that wash me clean again. But thank you, James, for those words. I never not need to hear those. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that's a good reminder for everybody. Not sure what that's all about. Thank you, James. I think it's a good reminder for all of us because sometimes we can forget that. And there are so many things, Doctor, that I could, as you were going through, first of all, I have to say thank you for your vulnerability and transparency. And you're right. I think we need more men to be able to share their stories because we know that the percentage of men are very, very high out there that were sexually abused as children, and we don't get enough support for men. There was something I was actually, you had said something when you were talking about, why didn't I say at 10 or why didn't I say at 20 or
or whatever age is. And I thought, you know, I think a lot of us have probably asked that throughout our lives at times is, you know, what took us so long to maybe say something. I mean, some of it can be dissociation, but another thing for a lot of people is simply not being in an atmosphere where we had people around us that we felt safe even coming forward. And, you know, as you had mentioned, your abuse started out very young. And because of that, in itself, that becomes our normal. So, you know, I'm not surprised that you didn't say something sooner. I could also relate, and I hope people can hear me because right now the screens are freezing up. So if for some reason, okay, CS is saying yes. I also could really relate to what you're saying where, you know, you didn't start dealing with this until well into your midlife and it showed up. And that's what happened for me as well. It wasn't until midlife that I actually started to deal with this. We have a couple hands up, a couple questions, and I know Evie wanted to try and get in here and try and say something too. So, Evie, if you wanted to jump in and say something quick, and
can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Yes. Wow, what a miracle! I just in case my sound goes out again. Thank you so much for sharing. Thank you for your bravery. I really appreciate, James, the support that you showed. Greg, I think it's so wonderful that we have another male on here. I wanted to say that I wish I could tell you every single day that every person in this room right now believes you. We believe you. And I think that you can't hear that enough. And I also want to say, you know, your story to me was also, like Elizabeth was saying, and like James was saying, it's very relatable, the type of trauma and the position in society that your abusers had is very much relatable to me and my story. And like you, mine didn't start coming out until I was 48 years old. And I think our minds just protect us until we're able to deal with it. And I really, with my children too, when I wrote my book, that's what I did too. My children and my husband, I fed them the chapters because that is really pretty much the only way I could tell them what happened. And there was no way I was gonna release a book until they knew first. Right. So thank you for your bravery. Thank you for your vulnerability and your honesty, and know that we've got you, and thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, one thing that I
see the hands maybe because I don't see them.
Go ahead, doctor.
I was just going to say one thing that I never received was anybody that said, you know, Greg, you're lying. We don't believe you. Mm-hmm. And I think after everybody looked back and saw and looked, the pieces fell together. And even my siblings, I have, because I saw that in the chat, I have a brother 5 years older than me, and he was in the same room with me in a twin bed across the other side. There's several times that I would be abused because Dad would abuse me after Johnny Carson got over. At night, Mom would go to bed. That was before she got the promotion. He would light a cigarette, and you could see and smell. You could see the amber of him puffing, and you could smell the smoke starting to come down the hall. And about 15 minutes later, I knew that he would be walking through the door, and I would become limp. I would just do the, I'm out, you know, and let him do whatever and just pray for it to get over fast. And every now and then I would look over at my brother. He always would check to make sure he was asleep. And every now and then Tony would be wide-eyed looking at me. And when my eyes would connect with his, he would roll over. Tony got ran over by a car across in the street at 36 and isn't with me. But I think he was abused. He had some issues. And then my oldest brother, 10 years older than me, is the most bitter, hateful individual. And I believe he probably was too. He left the house as soon as he could. I think you're like 16 years old. He left and hardly ever came back. Did not have a good relationship with dad. So I think he was probably abused too. And I was just the next one in line, to be honest with you.
And I think that goes to show how each one of us will deal with things differently. Evie and I have had conversations about, some of us go with our trauma, we become perfectionists. Others go the other route where we get angry and drug, different. Everybody deals with it differently. Darlene actually had a question. She's had her hand up for a while here. Darlene, did you want to go ahead and comment or ask a question?
Yes, I was wanting to comment.
Hey, Darlene.
Hi there.
How are you, dear?
Good seeing you.
Good seeing you.
I had to write it all down because it was so much I wanted to say.
Oh, boy.
You are not lying, Gregory. You are believed. You did not deserve this. You did nothing wrong. You were a child. They were the adults. They were responsible for you. We are all brave when we open up and share our stories. And I know it's more difficult for men to share their stories because they're supposed to be macho or whatever presented. So it's so much harder for men to open up. And I appreciate you coming and sharing your story and be willing to divulge these inner deeper things that it happened. And it happens to a great many other men as well.
Well, I appreciate it, Darlene. And I really think that if we, and I may be, you may just cut me off here in a minute after I say this, but I honestly believe that if you look up in right now and get on the internet and say, okay, what's the statistics of females and males being sexually abused before they're 18? I think you're going to probably come up with lots of different numbers, but the ones that the professionals that supposedly we have decided upon will be 1 out of 4will be sexually abused females before they're 18. Maybe 3 out of 10 males before they're 18. And I have a Greek word for that, and that's baloney. I honestly believe that it's 50% or more of females and equally of the males. I just believe that is the case. And the real fact that to me that resonates, and when I go around and speak around the country, I always indicate between 85 to 93% of the people that have ever been abused never tell anybody. Never. So they go to the grave in it. So how can we even tally up how many? And all you have to do is open up the newspaper, get on the internet, or turn the TV on. Probably tonight, there'll be another case of another sex ring that has been caught in Disneyland this week, another Olympic coach that has done something, and that was this year, that committed suicide because his was getting ready to be revealed, another millionaire that has protected all these politicians and entertainers that has this sex ring. It's everywhere. And I believe COVID's terrible, but the epidemic of child abuse is horrific because it is a choice that they are deciding to do and place on people. And it's time that I really think we need to get a control of it. And shows like yours, Elizabeth and Evie, are the answer. Keep letting people know we have the power to change this, break the cycle. And it's sad, but I may be wrong on the statistics, but that's just my guesstimate. And I've had Dr. Bruce Perry on my show and Vanderkelt and Brene Brown and all these, and they all say, oh, I don't think it's that high. Well, I'm not saying you're wrong. They're a lot smarter than me, but I'm talking to people, as many as I can every day, that need help. And there's a lot of them out there, and it's sad.
Absolutely. It looks like we have Robin would like to ask a question or comment.
Dr. Gregory, hi. Can you hear me okay, everyone?
I can hear you.
Great. Thank you for being with us for this session. I would tend to agree with you that statistically things are a lot worse than we are capturing the data about and capturing people's experience about. A couple of things for me. You talk about you said the epidemic of child abuse is horrific. I wrote that down. Given that you've got this background of understanding plus all of this personal experience, when you look at the literature or you hear people's stories, why do you think this exists in humanity, which is inhumane, but why? What's your perception of why this epidemic is actually in existence at all? Can you lend a little bit of maybe, I don't know, I'm not looking for any particular answer, just an impression of why you think this exists in our world?
Well, I hate to get religious, but evil exists. And sex is the one tool that can motivate and entice anyone to do anything at any given time. And we're probably all guilty of that at any given time. And I say, oh, wait, I would never do that. There's a manipulation that goes on in the brain. And when people are addicted to sex, and it's like a drug, and when the internet started coming on, and this was all pre-internet days. I mean, the internet wasn't even around when Dad was doing this to me. But can you imagine now people watching this online and then wanting to live it out? So the people that are involved in the oldest profession of all time, prostitution, their game changed when the internet came in, because it wasn't just people wanting to have sex with them. This is people now wanting to do bondage with them, wanting to do humiliation with them, wanting to do things that's not even normal. So I think the onset of the internet and has put fuel on the fire of the evil of all time. And it just it's like dropping a match in a dry wheat field. And it's just growing. It's like these out of control fires that's happening all over our country right now. And I don't know what it's going to take to put it out. I know that probably wasn't an answer that.
No, that's absolutely fine.
I really believe that my dad had a drive for it, that when he would pick me up after school, after he got off work from my aunt and uncle's house, the school bus dropped me off at their house. It was around 4:30, quarter to five. 9 out of 10 of those times, and we lived a mile away, he would sexually abuse me on the way home. And then I would go through it again later on that night. He just had a drive that could not be satisfied. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there like that today. And it is scary with me having grandkids around the country, what our children are being, the danger that's in front of them. It's sad.
I have another question, if I might. I know that you said that you waited until your mother had passed before you wrote the book and let that be part of the public domain. What do you think it is what advice would you give in terms of how do you know, or what contributes to a person being ready to tell their story?
Well, I started to, when I had open heart surgery, and there was no medical reason why my heart went bad. And it was only by an act of God that they actually found it. I wasn't even going to a heart doctor. I was going to a rheumatologist because I have circulatory disorders in my fingers. I have Raynaud's, you know, when it gets cool, I have to warm my hands up all the time. You know, they turn white and dark blue when it gets cooler out. That's why I love Houston, because it's always hot here. That helps. But so when he found that out, but I started to mentally, physically, emotionally, my wall that had been so beautifully put up, and I think Elizabeth touched on it earlier, I'm a perfectionist. I was the student that wasn't the bully. I was the student that sat in front of the class and got straight A's, president of the student council, on the national honor roll, a student of the year, and all of that stuff. And I became the angel because I didn't want anybody to think anything was wrong with me. But the older I got and the game and the mask started wearing thin on me emotionally, I had to finally stop being a liar to myself and the world. And I had to say, I'm hurting, I need help. And that's when, I think when people realize, and that's why I love, and I'm looking so forward to what the book will do with the youth, my youth version of the new book that's coming out, When Dark Clouds Come, is how do you tell somebody that you're hurting in a safe environment? And kids need to know that. Who can I go to and how to do it? But adults need to know that too. There's a GPS system in us that, for instance, if I'm going from Houston to Dallas and I get in my car and the first question my GPS in my car is going to ask me, if I don't already have it automatically navigated, where are you at right now? I know where I want to go. I want to go to peace. I want to go to safety. I want to go to healing. I want to go to hope. But until I recognize where I'm at right now, I'm useless. Have you ever called somebody and said, hey, Charlie, how can I get to your house? The question they always ask, well, where are you at? Oh, I don't know. Well, I can't tell you how to get there because I don't know where you're at. And I think that's the fact that I had to come to, is I never wanted to admit where I was at. And when I finally stood up and got brave enough to say, I was sexually abused, at that point, the wall broke, the weights fell off, the baggage got tossed out of the trunk of my car, and it literally was like the world was a different place. And to me, that was the beginning of my healing. Until then, I was playing a game. I was putting a Band-Aid on a 12-gauge shot wound in my belly, and the Band-Aid wasn't stopping any bleeding. It wasn't doing any good. It just got blood filled and fell off. And I get windy. I'm sorry, Robin, for answering that. I don't even know if I answered your question, but that's what was on my mind when you said it.
Can I wondering if you could give us a couple of examples of how to safely tell somebody, you know? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
So if you could give a couple of examples, that would be great. And I want to say, I don't know, hopefully you can hear me, that I think sometimes you just kind of know and trust when you're ready to stand in your truth and speak your truth. And I'm sure it wasn't immediately that you felt everything, you know, I always say it as, it felt like I was falling apart, but actually I was really coming together. But it's not instantly, But it's such a brave and wondrous thing we can do for ourselves, no matter how many people we tell, you know. It doesn't have to be a book. It can be just telling one person.
I think probably an example or two of how people can tell. One example that I always give everybody, because journaling was my salvation. I journaled from as early as I can remember. I had a notebook that I would put my feelings and emotions in. Back in those days, we may have called them diaries or whatever. Journals didn't really come out until, you know, Barnes and Noble decided let's put a notebook and put a leather thing on it and charge three times what it's worth. But I would write down my thoughts and my emotions. But everybody that I counsel right now, I say you have to have a vent. You have to have a release. And if it's anything, grab a notebook and bleed on the paper. Put it down. And they'll say, okay, I don't know how to do that. Okay, here's what I want you to do. Before we talk again, write down one instance. And I want you to tell me what the room looked like, every smell, what the temperature was, what the couch felt like or the car seat felt like, what you had on, what the color of the drapes were. And I want you to put every detail down. And then tomorrow, when you call me back, read it to me. And it gives them an ability to, first of all, grasp everything around them. Because a lot of times people see the abuse from an angel looking down. And I had somebody tell me they knew they were experiencing healing because they weren't up there looking down. They were inside looking up at the person that was abusing them. They knew at that point they were started to heal. So I would try to get, I'm trying to get my son out. Isn't that beautiful sunset? Anyway, I'm trying to get that out to where I'm not blinding y'all. And write all those emotions down. And then tell me. And then I always indicate, do you have somebody else that you can share a page of this journal with that you can trust? Well, maybe. Okay. Let them just read a paragraph and see what their reaction is. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. But when I let that first page be read by somebody I trusted, and it went, wow, I still love you. That was a huge mountain that I climbed. To me, that is probably one of the best examples that I can give of how to do that, or to find a good counselor. And I'm not knocking counselors. I am one, but there's not too many out there. I went to supposedly the best one in the country, paid him $400 cash money every 45 minutes I was in his office. And I went to him for about 3 months, worthless, absolutely worthless. Didn't help me a bit. He may be good at other people, but with me, it was terrible. But I would find somebody that I could trust and talk to and start sharing it. And that's why I think my phone rings off the hook, is because people can talk, share, and never have to tell me who they are. And people need to tell the story. That's why I named my show Breaking the Silence. Once you break the silence, there is a beginning of hope. And I hope those two illustrations helped.
Those are great. I think it was helpful to everybody here. Jennifer has actually been waiting quite a while to ask a question. Do you want to go ahead, Jennifer?
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you, Dr. Williams. Wow. Thank you so much for your vulnerability and your courage. I can relate a lot to your story. And I guess my question is, so in my case, I did speak up, but my perpetrators were the heads of the Catholic Church, and the police were involved, and the school board was involved, and the nuns were involved. And there were like 50 other children that were also being abused, and all of these organizations covered it up. And I'm running into survivors now as an adult that are running, and my own daughter was assaulted recently, and we went to the police, and I was talking to a perpetrator at the police, and he wouldn't even take a report. And I said, I'd like to speak with your boss. And he said, I am the boss. So how, I don't even know if you can even answer, I don't know if anyone can answer this question, but when the perpetrators are the judges and the police and the lawyers and the government, how, what can we do?
That's an unbelievable question. And with mine, I had the state attorney in, and the chief of police. I knew I couldn't. And I think I saw somewhere down the chat, although I'm not reading the chat, but I did see, did you expose them? Did they get arrested and all that? No way. Matter of fact, that's why, I don't even know if they're still alive, but that's why in my book, you really can't even tell what town I'm from. It wouldn't take a brain surgeon to be able to figure out where I'm from, but I did not want that to come back to haunt me, to where the family could come back and go, hey, wait, I could have been, you know, we live between three cities, so I could always say something, well, it wasn't that city. I stayed away from that fight because I think that would have probably scarred me even more with the fight. So I applaud you with what you've had to go through, Jennifer. And I believe that the movement that's happened now with this Me Too movement and the Larry Nassar and all of this other stuff that's come out may help put an extra bullet in your gun to fight back with them. But I don't know. I think every church, every organization needs to stand up and come clean. It's not just a Catholic thing. It's a Baptist thing. We had the front page story in the Houston Chronicle about our Baptist churches. It's a Methodist thing. And it's a Boy Scout thing. It's a Girl Scout thing. It's a Rotary Club. I mean, every organization, you get a group of people, it's going to happen. But I think we need to have a no tolerance law. And I don't know if that's ever going to happen in our society, because the uppers are involved in the deceit and the activity. So I don't have an answer for that, but that would be a solution. And I do love Texas because they are starting to do some legislation that helps those that's been abused to be able to act out and speak out without fear of retribution, but that's about the best answer I have for you, because it's tough.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I wish I had a better one. But isn't it sad that we re-abuse you by hiding it? Every time we hide it, it's another abuse. And I think we're better people than that. And that's what I love about these things. You know, I'm not here to answer questions. All I'm here is to reach out and grab your hand and say, hey, you want to walk on a journey with me? And this road's rough, isn't it? But if you can learn from me and I can learn from you, Jennifer, and then eventually you'll go your way and I'll go mine. But that time of those connections will make a difference in my life, and it'll make a difference in yours. And that's what I love about Elizabeth and Evie doing these kind of programs, and Darlene in Tennessee, and all those people that have their own shows. That's what it's all about, is helping each other get through the worst times of our life. And how we made it, only the good Lord knows. And I know he's the reason I made it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, like you had said, you know, not all therapists are good therapists. Mm. And I think to be able to gather as a community, as we are here tonight, or on your show or other people's shows or in different peer support groups, to be able to come together as a survivor community and walk this road together and learn from each other and support each other, I think that's where a lot of healing can happen. There's so much stuff that I would like to add and say, but I know we have a couple other people here that have had their hands raised. So we'll go ahead and let Mary, she has her hand raised. We'll go to Mary, and then when Mary's done, we'll go on to James.
Mary, you remind me of my Aunt Dorothy that helped raise me. So that you're an angel to me tonight. Thank you for looking the way you look, because it brings back good memories. And I need a good memory right now. How are you?
I do have an Aunt Dorothy too. So many things that you mentioned are just, my heart is just pounding, because I too have had a broken heart. And I did write my memoir. And so there's several things that really in my heart, after I wrote my book, and I have been, I used to do a lot of talking and stuff like that. And with the pandemic, I haven't, but I still share from time to time. I'm no longer afraid to say, you know, that I was abused, but the biggest perpetrator in my life was my ex-husband, who abused our kids. And I'm 100% sure that he has abused at least two of my grandkids, and one of them that I'm really, really worried about. But he says nothing has happened to him. He's 20 some years old. But when you talk about older people, so I just turned 75, and the older people that I talk to always tell me their story for the first time. So I really feel like I should have a mission of presenting to an older generation. I had at one point, right after my book was published, a 94-year-old woman told me her story. She asked if I would come because she read my book, and my cousin worked with her or in her nursing home. And she made me promise that I wouldn't go public with her story, but she just wanted to tell her story, and her kids did not want anyone to know about it. Even though in 1939, her father went to prison for abusing her. But it's important to those who are, you know, wherever they are, the older generation that haven't told their story. And so I went through a lot after my book was published. My kids, they knew it. They had the opportunity to read the book before I published it. They had the opportunity to say, I don't want my name in it. And I did all the right legal things in getting the book done. But it was my grandkids who didn't know, and my kids didn't want their kids to know. And I lived in such terror, because I knew I had uncovered, I unwrapped the whole story. Had been on Oprah 3 times and went through an incest treatment program. And just probably in the last year and a half, I realized that even though the incest treatment program was a good program, it really victimized me, because they didn't help me. They didn't help my son. It was the perpetrator and our daughters. And the damage is so, it's so hard, because I live it every day, just seeing how my kids are, their lives, even though they're all relatively successful. And then I began to realize that when I saw myself, and I let a few people see the video from Oprah, they really brought it forward to me about what damage she had done to me. And I began to realize that by being on her show and the way she treated me, I was being re-victimized. It was a really hard thing. And somebody, and I can't even remember now, just recently when I talked on a Zoom, actually went and got my book. And then she found the second time we were on the video I had never been able to get it. And when I asked permission to show it on the internet, I couldn't, the Oprah show wouldn't allow that. So when you talk about, you know, being a victim and then being re-victimized, so many things come up that make you feel like you have been the bad person, or that, you know, somehow living through it and telling your story doesn't always, I guess for me, I probably will go to my grave just feeling sad that I didn't protect my kids enough. And yet my daughter, my oldest daughter at 18, almost 19, when I asked her, she denied it, that he had done anything to her. He had kept her silent all those years. So we do wear that mask. We do cover up who we are. We become that person that we want people to see who we are, but we don't show that pain and hurt in our hearts. So thank you a million times for coming on this show. And well, it's not a show, but it's a Zoom, and sharing your story, because I believe that there's such a bigger number of men who've been abused.
You too, Mary. And you know, I'm going to use James' line. It wasn't your fault, and don't take the blame of your children. You protect them, and if you would have known it, you know you would have protected them even more. And that's when my kids, after they read the book, they said, "Dad, now we know why we never got to spend the night at Grandpa's house. We never got to be alone with Grandpa. We never got to go play golf with Grandpa." It's like, no, you never got, you know, he came over. It was, we'd always talk about the weather. We would never talk. And maybe before the show's over, I'll tell how it ended, because that's when my relationship with my dad changed. But they understood why I wanted to make sure I broke that chain in such a way. There's no way that cycle is going to happen with my kids. But if he really wanted to, he knew when they were home alone. He could have won. And he knew when I was working and their mom was working and Matt was watching the kids, you know, whatever. So he could have if he wanted to. But at that point, I think he was probably doing other things with other people.
You know, I have to say, Mary, you mentioned, and James, we're going to get to you in just a second here. I just wanted to say, I also have had people reach out to me. They're 95 or, you know, 80, late 80s, 90s, who never told anybody, and it's gone on generation after generation after generation. I had a 95-year-old call and say, "It happened to me, it happened to my daughters, it happened to my grandchildren, now it's happening to the great-grandchildren." So just the fact that we're all talking now, and as survivors, we are losing our shame, we are losing the blame that goes along with this terrible epidemic. That is going to make people eventually start coming forward. I really have to believe that, because as we get here to, in these groups, I mean, whether it's this or peer support group or whatever it is, every time we're getting together as a community of survivors and we're healing and we're learning and we're undoing all the, you know, tragedy that came before us, that's going to open up different types of conversations so that as we heal, it helps to prevent it. And, you know, I think there are a lot of people in the old, you know, especially, my mother, Mary, is in her 80s, and, things happen that I never knew about until I broke my silence. And so I think, you know, we're going to, you know, as we open up more avenues for people to be able to shed that shame and blame, you know, hopefully we'll be able to get more people that can say, you know what, that happened to me too. And I need, with that, James, you've been waiting here. Did you have a comment or question?
Sure. Yeah, I'll be quick, Dr. Williams, because you're in demand. you're an absolute inspiration. Everybody here is an inspiration. But you're speaking about your experience and you're talking about your books. I've got a couple of questions for you based on what we talked about tonight. A couple of questions that have come to my mind. I'm going to give you my background really, really briefly, without minimizing it. I'd be a childhood sexual abuse survivor, a murder survivor, would have been passed around satanic pedophile soul like you were by my biological father, biological brother. And my background is my people would have owned Ireland as an island after independence from the United Kingdom. So all of this darkness swirled around us politically. You know what I'm talking about because you described it with the people who abused you. I understand exactly what you're saying. Not that who would believe you. Plenty of people would believe you, but what could they do about it? These were the law. They were, you know, and there was decent people in my family, but the evil ones hid behind their good name to get away with horror. And I'm sharing that with you, I'm sharing that to identify with where you're coming from. A child is not supposed to even have to worry about that. So we don't feel bad about the kind of people who abused us. They had no business doing that to you or anybody in the first place. There's also my farm would have been used for genocide for children in Ireland as well. Murder, you know, they would have industrialized child killing and burial. I'm giving you the full facts of my background because I've got two questions for you. Now, I know we don't go into the minds of perpetrators. I'm aware of that because you could get lost. But something that's come to my mind is, would you agree that pedophilia is or could be classified as an illness like any of the 12-step programs like alcoholism, drug addiction, pedophilia? It's an addiction, a psychological malady, a spiritual, physical, psychological malady that can only be healed with a spiritual solution. That's question number one. Mm-hmm. And the second question is, Jennifer referenced it earlier on, and you went through it. Jennifer, who's of the Roman Catholic Church, was terrorized and abused by the Roman Catholic Church. You mentioned your abusers. Would you agree that the only way to ever empower survivors genuinely is to get them into positions higher than those abusers? That we can say, actually, hold on a minute. We're not going to allow this to happen. We're blowing the whistle. We're calling time. We're arresting the untouchables. We're arresting the unarrestables. We're the presidents. We're the attorney generals. We're the judges. And the game is up. The light is in control. I leave you with those two questions.
Wow. Great discussion. And anybody on this program that wants to be on my show, there's some wonderful guests on this panel that I would love to contact me. And I'll put my phone number down here in a minute in the chat room and you contact me. I'd love to have you on my show. But yeah, James, I do think the predators, the abusers are like drug addiction. I even believe that because of the cycle, because of generations passing down this type of behavior, that can almost be like a generational curse. and the average is three generations before somebody actually will break the cycle. So I'm assuming that my dad was abused by his father, and his father was the deacon of our church. His father before that could have done. So I personally think we're studying this at Baylor College of Medicine. We just got a grant that was okayed to, because if you're traumatized as a child, let's just say, and Jennifer, I don't want to put you on the spot, but let's just say you've made it clear that you were traumatized as a child or you've been abused. If you become pregnant now, do you realize the DNA inside that embryo is different because of the trauma that you went through as a child? It affects the stress that you hold within your body, affects that embryo inside that womb before it's ever born. It affects their DNA. So in a way, I think, and that's what we're doing with this grant, we're starting to look at miscarriages, SIDS, and all of that, and going, wait, is this just by chance? Folks, I don't think so. I think there's a majority, a predominant majority, that it could be because of something that happened to them as a child before they ever even thought about having a baby, years before that, that they're carrying around. Your body can only take so much. So I believe there could be a DNA change, James, in people because of addiction and addiction to sex that does affect, like they are hooked on cocaine, that they're hooked on meth, that they're hooked on alcohol. And my dad was an alcoholic too, so that sure didn't help. But yeah, I do believe that it can become that. All? No. But I do believe predominantly it could be passed on. And I do believe on the second part of that question that there has to be a higher power. And if it's not a higher power in the government or a higher power in the religious world, there's going to be a higher power one day that shines light on it and exposes it. But unfortunately, it's going to be too late because it's going to be in another place in eternity. But yeah, I believe it's time that, and we talked about that, that I really think that even in the church world, we need to say, if it happens, you are no longer able to be fit as a leader, and you need to go for counseling, therapy, intensive training, and you know, all of this before you're ever even, you know, brought back into any type of rationale leadership in any kind of church. But same way with schools, there's a zero tolerance. But that's a huge nut to crack, but it sure needs to be. I could talk an hour on that. And I'm editing myself as we get closer to 7:30. But back to Mary, do you know the reason why that generation didn't tell? Because a World War II generation, what happens in this home stays in this home. You know, I'll be darned if we're going to let anything out of this house. What were they doing? They were putting a fence around their home that everything was okay in that home because it was never going to get out. And that's what damages that generation, Mary, your generation and my generation, to the degree that we would have never told because we were ingrained. We keep it in this place. You do not tell anyone. And unfortunately, that's a huge mistake in what our children need to hear.
Vivian, do you want to say something?
I just really appreciate Dr. Williams and James and Jennifer as survivors of ritual abuse and government abuse, but all the family secret society things. I appreciate you coming forward. It can be a very lonely circle and a very small circle. And I have never been in a room with so many survivors who was like my story. So just personally, thank you very much. And I don't know how people come forward when people get caught like Jeffrey Epstein and things like that happen. I mean, it just pushes me more underground. But it is fabulous to be with a group of survivors who are willing to talk openly with each other. I don't know what the answer is, but I just want to say personally, thank you. And thanks for your bravery and coming forward. So I appreciate
it's a great panel you have, Elizabeth and Evie. You ought to be proud of the audience you have.
Thank you.
It's an awesome panel. Awesome group of people. I love each of you. I like to steal you myself.
You know, I have to say, that's the thing. We have a couple more questions here. Unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap stuff up in a little bit here. But I have to say, as I was listening to everybody here tonight, you know, a lot of times survivors will say, what can I do? You know, and it starts with us. It starts with going inside and healing and working on the shame and blame and learning and growing. But I think as a collective community, I mean, you know, Jennifer, when you were talking about clergy abuse, I worked with one of a prominent attorney that deals with the Catholic Church. And on a couple different projects together. But money is a huge thing that keeps this stuff hidden. But I really do believe as a survivor community, as we get healthier and as we get more bold and more, you know, hey, this happened to me, but as we grow in our strength, as we grow in our community, we actually, if we really put that to good use, we could really powerhouse some things. I mean, that's where coming together to get laws changed, to get voices out there, you know, as we grow and we get stronger, we have a lot more power than we even realize. And yeah. I think, you know, that's the importance of getting together and be able to, you know, be vulnerable and transparent. And it's hard. It's incredibly hard work. But as you guys all proved it here tonight, now, you know, you talk about getting long-winded, Doctor. I do the same thing, and I'll try and cut myself off. But, I mean, really, pat yourselves on the back for coming here tonight and sharing and having these tough conversations and throwing yourself out there, because this here is spreading light. The light gets bigger the more and more we're able to gather as a community of survivors and have discussions like this. There's healing in this. So, you know, piggybacking off of Evie too is, you know, thank you everyone who showed up here tonight, because, you know, we may have all had different experiences, but yet the feelings, the things that come out of abuse, I mean, we all share in that. We're all brothers and sisters in this. And it's just great to see. But I'll stop talking. And Jennifer, you had a comment. And then Amanda, we'll take your question. And then we better hand it back to Dr. Williams, and we'll have to finish up our show, unfortunately, tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me a chance to double dip. I wasn't going to say this because I didn't want to, like, steal the spotlight or anything, because this is not about me. But I'm kind of answering my own question that I asked you, because I was curious to hear you know, your perspective, Dr. Williams. But in my community, a survivor who was abused by the same priest that I was abused by went forward. And I saw there was a newspaper article about it, and I saw it. And that gave me the idea that, wow, she can go forward. Maybe I could go forward. And so I did go forward. And then there was like media coverage of that. And then after the two of us went forward, 50 people came forward. And it took a long time, but we successfully sued the priest. We sued the diocese. We sued the police. We sued the school board. We sued the whole community. And then I had to move away because they all hated me. But yeah, so like there's definitely strength in numbers.
Yes.
And yeah, so I just wanted to say that. But I think we as survivors need to get organized.
Yeah, I agree. And there is strength in numbers, absolutely.
Mandy, you can go ahead.
I just wanted to say thank you for coming on tonight. It's been very informative, and thank you for sharing your story. It was utterly heartbreaking to hear, and it made me feel like, wow, I've been through nothing compared to him, which I know you're not supposed to do that as a survivor, but I too deal with like the guilt and the shame and the regret. My earliest memories are, I'll be very short with this, but my earliest memories are my older brother doing sexual things to me, and then there was a gap where I don't remember if he did or not. And then when I was 11 through 13, he raped me several times a week. So for 2 years, I turned the tables on him at 13 finally, and I threatened him, you know, to stop it. And I too live with that regret of, why didn't I just do that earlier? You know, and I guess it's just because I was still a child. I look at another 11-year-old girl and I think, wow, she's just a baby. But, you know, you kind of look at yourself as should have done things differently. So thanks for sharing that, though.
Well, you know, man, I appreciate you being authentic and open. And of course, you've heard this before, I'm sure, but it doesn't matter if it was one person doing something in the office one time. The impact on your emotional, mental, psychological, physical, and all the olds is just as impactful as mine that happened a couple times a day, possibly for years. And it takes as much courage, as much strength to get over that one instance. So even though my story may be a little more gory or horrific, it doesn't diminish the impact of what everybody in this world has gone through with trauma and hurt and pain. And I always try to make sure everyone knows that pain's real and it does affect you. And if you don't get help, if people don't get help and don't have avenues to get help, it'll uproot them as bad as it did me emotionally later on after 35 years of silence. So I appreciate your openness and I thank you.
Okay, I think it's 7:30. So we have a wrap up.
All right, so there's a little pause there. I didn't know if you were having troubles with the audio there, Evie, but I just want to remind everybody that Thursday evening we do have our peer support group. That's, you know, specifically a peer support group to help in between people's therapy sessions, just another way of getting together as a community to hear each other, support each other on our healing. So a reminder that next Monday, again, we'll have conversations with Evie and Elizabeth. And looks like next week we will have Sarah Payton, author of Your Resonance Self, will be here next Monday evening at 6 p.m. Central Time. Dr. Gregory, I have a question for you. If there's one thing you could say, putting you on the spot, if there's one thing that you could say to survivors out there, what would you say that you think is kind of like one of the important things of healing?
No matter what, and I end my program every week with this, no matter what you've gone through, no matter what you're going through right now, no matter what you're going to deal with tomorrow, I promise you there's hope. There's hope. And you have to dig deep some days to find it. But there's always, always hope. As long as you're breathing, there's hope for you. And if you don't have anybody, give me a call. I put my email there. I put my cell phone number there. And it goes right here. I will answer your emails and your text, usually within 10 minutes, 24/7. I am that kind of praise. Person that I just love to reach out, because when somebody wants an answer, they need it now. They don't want to wait 2 weeks to get it. And I will respond to you. I can't answer the phone a lot of times because I'm in the hospital setting, but there's always hope. And I appreciate the people tonight showing me that you found hope and you found courage and you found strength. And thank you, Evie and Elizabeth, for allowing me to share. And anytime I can come back, I'd love to. And I want y'all on my show. And I will be out reaching out to you to get you there.
Thank you. Well,
Evie, did you have anything else before I close up?
No.
Poor Evie.
Poor Evie. I know you had so much stuff you wanted to say. But
I know. But thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Big hearts. Thank you.
And Dr. Gregory, thank you again for coming on here tonight and sharing your experience and your knowledge with us. It was a great program, and absolutely we would love to have you back. And I know we had so much conversation, good conversation tonight, that I know there's just so much more to have. So definitely would love to get you back on the schedule whenever you have a chance. And for those of you out there tonight, I think Dr. Gregory had some great words of wisdom to hold on to hope. And I think sometimes in this journey, it can be really tough. We have those dark times too, where we fall into pits, and sometimes we forget that there is hope. But clinging on to that is important. And remember, Dr. Gregory Williams said, reach out to him. As always, reach out to Empower Survivors. Check out the different programs. You know, reach out to someone, because there's no reason to suffer in silence by yourself. And with that, I just want to say I hope you all have a lovely night. Thanks again for coming and being a part of the show. And thank you, Dr. Gregory, again, for all your wisdom and the great conversations. It was a pleasure to meet you, and a pleasure to meet everybody on this panel here tonight. I think Evie and I, every week, we meet and we discuss the organization and survivors and different things. And we're both really honored to be able to be on this journey with all of you. So thank you. And I hope you all have a wonderful, lovely night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Conversations with Evie and Elizabeth by Empower Survivors, a nonprofit organization of survivors helping survivors, providing safe spaces of healing. It is an honor to have you here and be a part of your healing journey. Join us for one of our next online meetings on Mondays and support groups on Thursdays. For more information about our programs, visit empowersurvivors.net. We don't have to do this alone. We believe you, we see you, we hear you, and we are here for you now.